Hoffman. I'll start with a few biographical details. So Roald got his PhD in chemistry at the University of Harvard. And in 1965, he took a position at Cornell, where he spent his entire career, and he's now professor emeritus. So Roald works on the electronic structure of molecules and intermediate states in chemical reactions. He has a long list of prominent chemistry awards, including awards in both organic and inorganic chemistry, which is unusual. And in 1981, he shared the Nobel Prize in chemistry for his theoretical work on the course of chemical reactions. Roald is also well known for his outreach work. So in the late 80s, he was the host of a television series entitled The World of Chemistry. You can still watch it on YouTube today. And since 2001, he's been running a cabaret at a cafe in New York City, which is about the connection of art and science, and they have monthly meetings. He's written three books, mostly on the connection between art and science. He's also an accomplished playwright and poet, and perhaps some of you had a chance to hear some of his poetry. He was doing a reading yesterday at the University of Waterloo. So we're very lucky to have him with us today. And with that, I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you. So I don't know if the microphone works, but I presume it does.
Can people hear at the back?
Yep. So if this were shown in Europe, I wouldn't have to tell you what it is. But in the United States, if you haven't experienced Asterix, then there is something that awaits you, which is great. So this is Obelix applying high pressure to some poor Romans, okay? It can be done in very measured ways. I want to talk to you about the chemical imagination at work in very tight places, and every word here is going to have a meaning by the end of the talk. It's work that I've done together with Neil Ashcroft, who many of you know as a co-author of a great physics textbook with Ashcroft and Merman. And Neil and I have been working the last 10, 12 years on materials at high pressure, which actually has occupied Neil for much longer. I'm the newcomer here. So pressure. The units are variable. We think of atmospheres, which is about a bar. The unit that we're going to be using are gigapascals, and 10,000 atmospheres is a gigapascal. The other calibration point is the pressure at the center of the Earth. Of course, it's greater at the center of larger planets, but it's about 3.5 million atmospheres, or 350 gigapascals. That also represents the high limit of what can be achieved in the laboratory in static experiments. I'll explain that in just a moment. Just to get an idea of what is involved in this in the realm of high pressure, there's another perspective, and that's to tell you what happens to the volume of things that you know as you apply such high pressure. So some things are pretty compressible, like hydrogen, solid hydrogen. But most things, like solid lithium or an organic molecule, methane, which at low temperature is solid, a gas at atmospheric pressure, the volume... So the only imperative under high pressure is to get closer together. There's no choice. There's no choice. You're increasing the density. The mass per unit volume. So the volume of something like liquid or methane decreases by a factor of 5, ionic solids or water by about 3, and what we think of as metals, where there aren't, we think, any nooks and crannies left, Then there are, I'll come back to that, is about 1.7. So you take the cube root of that and you get the decrease along any one dimension. So this is the realm really of Superman squeezing the hell out of things. That is, things are coming closer together. Now, chemists are used to high pressure in industrial processes. The Haber-Bosch process, which makes ammonia out of N2 plus 3H2, is the most successful industrial process there is in this world. Let me tell you the mark of the success is half the nitrogen atoms in your bodies have seen the inside of a Haber-Bosch factory. There's another way of saying this. Half the people in this world wouldn't be living except for the synthetic fertilizers, which are how those nitrogen atoms go from ammonia into the bagel that you eat inside to your bodies. So it's a very successful process. And here's a typical diagram. And you see here that there is something being run at 130 to 300 atmospheres. You can buy for a few million dollars a big reactor that'll do this, run something at 300, 500 atmospheres. For the people in a high-pressure community that I'm talking about, an atmosphere like this of 300 atmospheres for an industrial process, that pressure is viewed as near vacuum. Just a difference in perspective. Because they're talking about pressures at the center of the Earth. And that's, as I said, 3.5 million atmospheres. So this is a number of orders of magnitude up. Those pressures can be achieved in the laboratory in between by compressing things between two diamonds that are leveled off at a certain point. And what's done is you take a sheet of metal, you drill a hole in it, you put a diamond from the top, you put the diamond from the bottom. I've reduced the simplicity to describe a diamond anvil cell. The actual cell you can hold in your hand. It's put into a press that is a hydraulic or mechanical press. And you can get up to, at best, you can get up routinely to a million atmospheres in there. But your reaction chamber is very small. And the higher pressure you have, since pressure is force per unit area, you have to reduce the area if you want a very high pressure, if you have the same amount of force. And so the volume of this reaction chamber is rather small. In the highest pressure experiments, reaching those at the center of the Earth, the diamond is maybe maybe 100 microns across. There are larger cells made from polycrystalline diamonds or from other materials like this Paris Edinburgh, so sort of a meter or so. You can get a reaction vessel there of about a millimeter cubed. That's a lot of atoms, a millimeter cubed. It's a fraction, a very small fraction of Avogadro's number, but it's still a lot of atoms, and those have been used for various things. Then there is another way of achieving high pressure, and this is through shock waves. So this is an old Mercury capsule re-entering. It's the slide that I found, the visual, and there is the shock wave in front of it. Today, these things are done at the National Ignition Facility. There's different ways of saying it. If fusion doesn't work, you gotta repurpose those $1 billion of lasers that you've got in order to do something else. And that is to do studies at high pressure. That's what goes on at the National Ignition Facility. And what you have there is not static conditions. And what you have there is you climb what is called a Huguenot. You climb as you're compressing, the pressure goes up, but you can follow it. You can do X-ray scattering in nanoseconds off the material in front in that shock tube. but also the temperature is rising to a few thousand degrees, so that you have both T and P rising, whereas in a diamond anvil cell, you can control the temperature and you can just have the pressure rise where you want to. Okay, so what do you get? What you've gotten for a long time is what you see here, diamonds, just to get oriented here. Here is diamond and graphite, remarkably of about the same thermodynamic stability. The Gibbs energy is within a 1/40th of an electron volt of each other under ambient conditions. But you notice that the densities of diamond and graphite are very different. Diamond is much denser than graphite. What that means is under pressure, remember under pressure, anything that takes up less space is going to be more stable than anything that takes up more space. So that under pressure, graphite doesn't have a chance. At just a few gigapascals, diamond becomes more stable. In particular, in the mantle under the surface of the Earth, you get diamond, which then comes up through kimberlite pipes, and that's the way the diamond is made. And the diamond is made naturally, but it also is also made in the laboratory. What you make is not gem quality diamonds. Now, today, there are still other methods of doing diamonds, but to date, making industrial diamonds is the only major commercial application of high pressure synthesis. This is a problem for the field because you need, there are a lot of fields of science which get along on a basis of basic interest, but it's good if you have a commercial application. And one of the interesting things is if you do have a process tomorrow for making gem quality diamonds, I would not suggest publishing it. It is not in the interests of De Beers Mines or Russia that diamonds be made cheaply. And Agent 0011 will be sent out immediately to do away with you if you were to find a way to make diamonds cheaply. Though, who knows? Maybe General Electric has an unwritten contract with De Beers Mines not to make gem quality diamonds. Who knows in the conspiracy world? Okay. Under extreme pressure, under pressure, the imperative being to get closer together, every gas turns into a liquid and every liquid turns into a solid because they take up less volume. It's nothing very special here. So you solidify under pressure. Some of the things are quite remarkable. And one of the other things that's of interest, that's a phase transformation. It's pretty obvious. I'll come back to it in a while. But the other thing is that under pressure, most everything, until recent times people thought everything, but there are some very fascinating exceptions, which we could talk about at the end. But virtually all materials become metallic under compression. And this is just levels spreading out into bands, and the bands eventually overlapping. On the way becoming metallic, as this picture shows, they become colored. That is, you start out from something with a big band gap, goes to a small band gap, and then eventually the band gap vanishes. I wanted to show you something from work done just a kilometer or so from here. This is work from Dr. Oakley's laboratory. I just wanted to show you something that the growing metallic, that this is not just a theoretician's dream. It happens to be a molecule which is a so-called stable free radical. And if you subject that to pressure, and the pressures here are not gigantic, they're just a few gigapascals here. You see here the conductivity at left, and here you see the gap between the filled and unfilled levels, and it vanishes at an application of a certain pressure. So this is just an example of metallization, a metallization under pressure. The interesting things about what happens to chemistry or to physics, however you, things can be metallized, and things you do not expect. I don't know if you've seen a sample of xenon. Yes, xenon is the proverbial lead balloon. You make a balloon of xenon, and instead of floating up, it drops. It's just more dense than air. But xenon is definitely a gas. But you can not only liquefy and solidify xenon, but people have made xenon metallic. So wrap your mind around that, this gas that is being made into a metal. And that is part of the interest. Iodine, that's less of a stretch because iodine is colored already. That means the gap between filled and unfilled levels isn't very high. And under compression, that gap, just a few gigapascals, make it metallic. You can make ionic substances metallic, like cesium, iodide, and barium telluride. No one has made sodium chloride metallic. It will take some terapascals to do that. Much more than we can subject in a laboratory, but you can make ionic substances metallic. To chemists, probably the most striking things are these, carbon dioxide and nitrogen. So carbon dioxide is of course a gas, and we know the solid as dry ice. It's something familiar to all of us. Nitrogen we know as a gas, and we know it as liquid nitrogen. Also in a laboratory very often. Under pressure at about 50 gigapascals, carbon dioxide goes into a quartz-like structure. So now it's an interesting story which we don't tell students about, which is why quartz is quartz and carbon dioxide is not quartz. But it's interesting that under pressure, it goes into behaving like silicon. And N2, under pressure, and I'll tell you why in just a moment, though it's fairly obvious why. N2, which is a diatomic molecule and a gas, when you apply pressure and also you do an excursion at in temperature, transforms into a form where it's a three-coordinate net, and it resembles the structure of arsenic and antimony in their elemental states, one of the structures of those elements. Here is the story. Hydrogen has been at the top of people's interest from the beginning. Hydrogen, of course, being a diatomic gas. From the very first papers, people have by Hunter and by Huntington, the Wigner and Huntington paper of 1930s, people have speculated about hydrogen being metallic. Neil Ashcroft has worked on this from the 1960s. Not only is it going to go metallic, but it's likely to go superconducting and maybe a superfluid. So hydrogen is very interesting in a number of ways. There is a story about predictions and experiment. To this day, the question of can you metallize hydrogen? No problem in making hydrogen solid. You cool down to near absolute zero, your hydrogen goes solid. But now you can squeeze it. You can compress hydrogen between one atmosphere and low temperatures and 350 and 500 gigapascals. It compresses the volume of the solid by a factor of 11. Imagine taking the cube root of 11, which is 2 plus, and that's the dimensions growing. Not the distance between the hydrogen atoms and the hydrogen molecule. It remains molecular. We'll come back to that, and I'll show you that in a moment. Anyway, has hydrogen been made metallic? Has been the subject of contention in the physics community, and it continues to be to this day. Here are, for instance, two papers. One was by Aramets and Troyan in 2011, which claimed that they had metallized hydrogen. And immediately, three of the prominent experts in the field wrote a nasty paper saying these guys are all wrong. A few years later, one of those experts who said that Eremetz and Troyan were wrong in this, and that's Ike Silvera, who is a leading person in the hydrogen community, he claimed to have made finally metallic hydrogen, whereupon three other papers told them that they're all wrong and that the pressure calibration was all off. Stay tuned, okay? There is no agreement in the community whether in static measurements hydrogen has been metallized. But under shock tube conditions, fluid hydrogen has been metallized. No one doubts that. That's reproducible. And it's Bill Nellis, who was now at Harvard, was then at Los Alamos, who was responsible for this experiments, which are now at high temperature and high pressure, going up this shock tube curve. So both are on there. We got into this when Neil came to us and we established a collaboration. And Neil had this simple idea that maybe you could fool, that's not the right word, maybe you could induce hydrogen to metallize at a lower pressure than what it does normally by seeding the hydrogen gas, let's say, with some other atoms which would bond to the hydrogen and make it forget, I'm using these anthropomorphic terms, make it forget that it should be repelling the other hydrogens, okay? And he suggested silane, as this. So silane, SiH4, might be a, so the silicon is the thing that you're adding to the hydrogen. It's forming chemical compounds. SiH4 in a gas phase is the tetrahedral molecule, as you see over here. It's no great fun to work with. It auto-ignites at normal conditions, but that doesn't prevent tons of it from being made. In the semiconductor industry, this is used as an etching agent. And there is a lot of silane being handled and made. So that got us into our first paper, which, as you see, is about 12 years ago with Neil. Rather amusing paper that there's two graduate students, the rest of the people were professors here. But we asked, here's what the problem that we are facing. We wanted to predict what is the structure of silane under high pressure. Now, turns out that there is no crystal structure of silane, SiH4, under one atmosphere. And the reason there isn't is that the molecule is tetrahedral, as you saw, and just like methane, CH4, silicon is under the carbon in the periodic table, the molecule is quasi-spherical, so that this solid is what's called a rotational solid. So that as you go even to the lowest temperature, the methane molecule, the silane molecules are rotating around. They don't get frozen into one structure. So we had to guess, and we did calculations at one atmosphere, but then we were going to subject it to higher pressure. So we asked our colleagues, what do you think silane will be like at higher pressures? So this is what came from Neil's group. He said silane is likely to have this structure. So first thing, I know most of you know this, but I would just have to get us used to it. Gold is silicon, green is hydrogen here. This is not silicon 9H8. This is one unit cell of SiH4. The unit cell contains 8/8, shared with 8 unit cells here, plus 1 here, that's 2 silicons, and 8 hydrogens, which makes up the stoichiometry SiH4. Okay, I look at this as a chemist, I say, you guys are crazy. This is well, to suggest this for the structure of silane is the analog of the famous spherical cow argument, which our agriculture school loves. That is, you want to model a cow, let me assume it's a sphere and put in the cowness as a perturbation, okay? So this is, but who knows? Maybe under high pressure, it'll go into this, but right now, this silicon is 8 coordinate in hydrogens around it. That's not a typical thing. Silicon wants to be 4 coordinates. So here are 3 structures, which we suggested. And again, you have to get used to this. That is not an isolated SIH bond. If you repeat the 8 unit cells which are adjoining, you would reconstitute an SIH4 molecule. This is just what's in a unit cell. And these are 3 structures with 1, 2, and 4 SIH4 molecules in a unit cell. It's what you would predict from seeing silicon as under carbon in a periodic table, okay? But now there is more that chemistry can tell you, because the periodic table has persisted as a useful thing for chemists and physicists. In part, because it is a summary of similarities. Silicon H4 will be like CH4. But overlain on that is difference. So if it were just similarity, it wouldn't be good for anything. But chemists know that silicon is like carbon, but silicon is unlike carbon. So in what way is it unlike carbon? One of the ways is that whereas carbon really doesn't like to go 5 or 6 coordinate in discrete compounds, silicon has no problem going 5 or 6 coordinates. So for instance, this here is the equilibrium structure in a solid state, not of silicon H4, but of tin F4, SnF4. Now it happens that tin is under silicon. You go down, you hit germanium, and then tin, and then lead. And the F is like a hydrogen. So this is not SN, this is not SIH6. These 4 that I'm pointing to are shared with 2 unit cells. So those are 4/2 plus the 2 within the unit cell make SIH4. So knowing that tin or silicon like to be 6 coordinate makes these, from a chemical perspective, possible structures. So we, in fact, examined 13 structures. And, oh, there is a paper where we talked about this. Let me just, it was in a chemistry journal. Let me just explain one little thing here. We wanted to draw something funny. It's got too much information in here. We wanted to give some samples. And we did manage to get in something. At that time, Poland wasn't doing too well economically. One of the co-authors' heroes was Polish. And so we got this in. We sneaked that past the editors, that 1,000 GPA Polish unemployment rate was going to go down. But somehow they didn't see this. We expected that to be taken out. This causes another problem. So in Europe, this is okay. But in the United States, if you show this, you get accused of sexism. So we knew this. We knew this. So what we did is I had a Polish postdoc, and from her, I borrowed a pair of high-heeled shoes, of stiletto heels. The pressure under a stiletto heel is about 1/100 of a GPA, about 100 atmospheres. Editha, that was the only pair of stiletto heels she had ever worn one time in her life. I borrowed it. We painted my toenails red, and that's my foot in her high heels. And for $100 Canadian, I'll sell you an original print of that. Okay, just having fun. What I want to show you something, let's see if the next slide has this. Oh, I'm missing a slide. Okay, it'll come up later. I want to tell you, we learned a lot from this paper, from this one paper. And I want to tell you a little bit about what we learned from this and a few other papers. We've been working on this for 12 years. I want to tell you something about what happens to structure in response to pressure in terms of sort of general ideas. And I want to set up a kind of hierarchy of response of matter, molecular or extended, to pressure in crystals. It's also true in amorphous matter. And it's set up in terms of four sort of regimes. These are not rules saying that A will happen, then B, then C. They overlap. But at least something along these lines happens. And the first one is penetrating the repulsive region of intermolecular potentials. So let me talk about that. Intermolecular potentials. What I'm talking about here is London or dispersion forces. The weak forces between atoms and molecules, which come from polarizabilities, induced dipole interactions, fall off as 1 over r sixth. They trace out the usual kind of potential energy curve, attractive at long distances, repulsive at short distances. The attractive part, of course, varies tremendously. And of course, there is a correlation with melting point. This is what this is about what holds liquids and solids together are these attractive interactions. So obviously, it's going to be greater for xenon than it's going to be for helium, where the helium, the depth of that well, is a fraction of a wave number for, I may not have it right, but for any molecule, any other atoms, it grows bigger. It's what holds that and multiple interactions is what holds together, for instance, a crystal of benzene. This is just happens to be a structure of an organic molecule, C6H6, and holding it together in the solid, and to a certain extent in liquid, are these dispersion interactions. Now, everyone is interested in the attractive part of dispersion forces. The reason is that that attractive part, the depth of this well, and distance which it occurs, is what's responsible for liquefaction solidification. No one, as a first approximation, is interested in the repulsive part of this potential. Some people are so little interested in it, they approximate it by a line going up to infinity, a solid wall. Under high pressure, there ain't no walls that will not collapse. That is, you apply something to that wall, it's going to collapse. And what you're doing when you're going to high pressure is you're reducing internuclear distances. So you're moving into the repulsive region of the van der Waals potential. Let me show you the extent to which this happens. And here I show you numerical experiments, but they also are supported by experimental facts. Here is that silane, SiH4. And now I'm squeezing that silane in that structure which has 2 molecules of SiH4 per unit cell. And I'm squeezing it from 0 to 160 gigapascals, 1.6 million atmospheres at the right. Here is the intermolecular HH distance. That's the distance from one green atom here to another green atom of the other molecule, not the SiH distance inside. It's the HH distance. And you can see that in the first 10 gigapascals, it drops by 1 angstrom. Here is H2 itself in its structure, H2 being a solid. Again, over now a bigger range, 500 gigapascals. Over this, almost the entire range, up to about 450, it remains molecular. But all that happens, So that dot there, incidentally, is not an H atom. That's just the top of an H2 molecule that's going down into the screen. The distance I'm talking about here, plotted here, is the second nearest distance, the first neighboring atom distance from here to here. And that also drops in the first 10 gigapascals by a full angstrom, while the HH separation changes by nothing, by about 2/1000ths of an angstrom. So this is what I mean by penetrating the repulsive region of the van der Waals potential. That is squeezing out van der Waals space. That space between molecules is empty space. It's repulsive. It's attractive first, then it gets repulsive, but it, despite the drawing of over here, and even though this is modeled by a 1/r^12 potential typically, it's still possible to squeeze in this curve. The energy axis is not given sufficiently. You can see here how these things come together, the space is squeezed up. Okay. Supposing you squeeze out all that space, what happens next? Next, roughly at the same time, next, in terms of, the next thing that happens is you increase the coordination at main group and transition metal elements. So increasing coordination just means that it's got more neighbors next to it. That's all that it means here. So that's what's at work with CO2 and nitrogen. So whereas CO2 has a very nice molecule, and it has carbon and oxygen and oxygen, but the next molecule is over here. And while this distance may be short, this one is long. And so let me put it another way. Let's say the long is, we're not going to count it. The carbon's two coordinate here, the oxygen is one coordinate here. In quartz, which is in which each silicon in quartz has an oxygen, an oxygen, an oxygen, an oxygen bonded to another silicon, it's the oxygens are two coordinate and the silicon is four coordinate. And so this has got a higher coordination, and it works. Oh, it's okay. I won't need that again, I think. The question in the nitrogen case is that the nitrogen in a diatomic molecule is one coordinate. It has one nearest neighbor. But in that three-coordinate net, that nitrogen assumes by taking on the structure that arsenic and antimony or something like that have, it becomes three coordinates. So it gets more neighbors. So what's going on here is something like would go on in a New York City subway. You go on, if you plot the distribution of people in New York City subway, people have actually done papers on this. The study on the low population limit of nearest neighbor interactions in New York City subway cars is actually interesting because there's a bimodal distribution. Most of the time, privacy or safety concerns cause people to sit as far away from each other as possible, except there's a little peak right next to each other. That's lovers. And they sit always next to each other, right? So that's the bimodal. As you go up, you get two nearest neighbors, and over here, you approach six nearest neighbors in a normal subway car at rush hour. It can get worse. This is the Tokyo subway. Over here, there are people hired to apply higher pressure to people who are coming into Tokyo subway cars. Basically, this is the sardine can principle. If you want to pack things, you got to get closer together. You want to decrease the volumes. Nothing very fancy over here. Now, this was something interesting, and it goes on to, it allows me to give another point. Here is something. Remember I told you we were looking for silicon? I want to show you it again. Here, we had 13 structures, and I'm going to show you now in a moment one of the structures and how it changes. We started out with one of these, but as we applied the pressure and did not limit the space group in which the symmetry operations, in which the pressure was applied, this thing went to some lower symmetry, which allowed it to gain more nearest neighbors than the 4 or the 6 over here. And in fact, it went to 8 nearest neighbors, but it did not assume the structure that Neil had suggested, but another one. I'm going to show it to you in a moment. And allow me also to make another point about this. This is the structure we found, a beautiful dodecahedra. Again, gold is silicon, green is hydrogen. Let me describe the structure. There are these polyhedra of hydrogens, each centered by a silicon. And here I've stripped away one of those gold, of those polyhedra. So you can see at the center a silicon that has a squashed tetrahedron of hydrogens around it and an elongated tetrahedron of other hydrogens around it. It's 8 coordinate. So it's got higher coordination. That's why it's stabilized at, I've forgotten what pressure we did this now. And each hydrogen is shared with 2 silicons. Each silicon has 8 hydrogens around it. Each hydrogen shared with 2 silicons. That's how you get SiH4. It's now 8 coordinate. This is not at 1 atmosphere. This is at a higher pressure. Interesting. What kind of bonding does one have in that? Well, we took some interest in that, but let me digress on something else. Meanwhile, another group, Pickard and Needs at Cambridge, looked at the same problem of SiH4, and they applied a different procedure. I didn't tell you what procedure we found, we applied to find the minima, but you saw it. We guessed some structures based on chemical intuition, that silicon wants to be 4 coordinate or 6 coordinate, and we threw in Neil's 8 coordinate in there, but we really didn't believe it. But we did those based on chemical intuition. What they used was another method. It's called RAISS, which is really random searching. So let me describe this method. So what you do is you take a unit cell. You specify the number of atoms in a unit cell. They specify 2 silicons and 8 hydrogens. Then you use a random number generator to 10,000 times generate the coordinates of 2 silicons and 8 hydrogens in that unit cell. Then you use a workhorse program of the community run at low resolution to order and to optimize in energy the structures. The program some of you may know is called VASP. It's a Vienna simulation program. And then you pick the 20 lowest structures and you optimize those with a better program. And they got the structure at left here, which is at lower enthalpy. You have to worry about enthalpy when you have pressure and volume in the thing, rather than just energy. And lower enthalpy than our structure. And it has also, that's a little hard to see, but you have to believe me, each silicon is also bonded to 8 hydrogens, but 2, they are bonded pairwise. You see this over here? These 2 hydrogens are shared between 2 silicons. So it's rather close to this, but it's different, and they beat us. Okay, now I have to tell you the sad story. The sad story is that the random number programs plus more intelligent things like machine learning, which is not intelligent, neural networks, which is, and genetic algorithm methods. There are still other methods. But every method out there which uses these random starting points beats us. How am I going to keep on living in a world where simulation beats understanding at every point? That's a more general thing, and I'm writing about that. It's turning into a book, but it's an article. And that is the tension between simulation and understanding. It's in all our fields. Your pension funds are being invested in programs which are making investment decisions based on zero knowledge about the companies they are trading in, but simply on fluctuations in day-by-day trading. And that's the world that we are about to live in, and it's an interesting world. How we remain human in that world. It's not just a matter that a machine can beat you at playing Go. This is another story. I can tell you a few more of, we all know the simulation stories. So anyway, you increase coordination. This is something that chemists know, that you sometimes increase coordination even at one atmosphere so that even when you have no pressure, but you sometimes want to form more bonds, you form more bonds than you would normally have. And so here is B12H12 2-, in which each boron is 6 coordinate, 5 bonded to 5 other borons in an icosahedron and 1 on the outside. Here is PF5, which is 5 coordinate. I've chosen these not at random. These are examples of what chemists would call electron-rich or electron-poor bonding. There are examples where you form more bonds than normal. Let me show you how you can use structural information at one atmosphere to draw a conclusion about increased pressure. Okay, so... what I'm going to look at is something called the Cambridge Structural Database. So let me set this in perspective. Chemists in 200 years of frenetic activity have added to this world about 100 million well-characterized compounds. Okay? Question what well-characterized means. Out of those 100 million compounds, about 1% have had their crystal structure done in the last 50 years or so. Though the first crystal structure was done for molecules or for the first crystal structures were done just about 100 years ago on diamond and graphite, in fact, during World War I. There is about 1 million things that we know the structure of. So for reasons which are not clear to you, we looked at fluorine, antimony, fluorine, about as useless one you could look at, but we looked at it for some reason. We looked at the distances and that among the 1 million compounds, which you can search, and we found 500 compounds, okay, in there. And we looked at those where the fluorine, antimony, and fluorine were along a line, okay? And then we plotted them out, but in a certain way. If R1 is the distance fluorine to one antimony, and from the antimony to the other fluorine is R2, we plotted the overall length of the molecule, that's R1 plus R2, the overall length of the molecule, versus the asymmetry, R1 minus R2. Okay, zero means the two bond lengths are the same. And now, so why are we doing this? The reason is that the overall length of the molecule, its inverse, is a surrogate for the pressure. So the molecule is big, and now if it happens to be smaller, that's what would happen if you applied pressure to it. So going this way, but I'm using everything in one atmosphere. So what the heck is applying the pressure to this? It's the other ions, the other atoms in the molecule. It's the chemical environment that's supplying the equivalent of pressure to that. So what I'm plotting out here and what I see is as I increase the pressure, you can see it up there, the molecules are going symmetrical. Let me translate that into English. At low pressure, long stretch of the molecules, the thing is asymmetrical. One bond is short, the other bond is long. I increase the pressure, thing becomes symmetrical. The antimony goes from one coordinate to two coordinates, so that I'm using, it's a little, this is the hardest slide in the whole talk from a point of view of chemistry. What happens next? The next thing that happens is you, I'm a little warm, so I'm going to do a clothing change here.
Operator, I wonder if we could get the lights the way they were at the beginning of the talk. It's a bit dark in here.
Okay, next thing that happens, can you hear me again? Next thing that happens is after you've got more neighbors and you've squeezed out the van der Waals space, the next thing that happens is you finally start squeezing on the bonds. Now that is the next thing that happens. And here there are some interesting things. And eventually you go into something when you squeeze very high. Not quite the inside of a neutron star, but inside at the core of Jupiter, let's say, when you squeeze very hard, then there is a new world where the electrons move off the atoms. And I want to tell you a little bit about that new world. I'm taking a jump over decreasing the bond lengths of covalent bonds to the last thing. So I want to tell you about something which you're not likely to find in textbooks, but yet which we can perhaps apply some chemical intuition to. This is a story of the structures of the alkali metal and alkaline earth metal elements, the first and second row in a periodic table. And here is the news, which has not penetrated any chemistry textbook. And that is, in the last 20 years, we have learned that the structure of every one of the elements that I have circled there goes out of closest packing into a lower symmetry structure. And I want to show you some of these because they're quite incredible. Here is, the first up is barium. So barium starts out in a body-centered cubic structure. This is metallic barium. No other elements, no molecules, nothing, just barium metal. It starts out BCC. We know BCC as being 8 coordinate. There are 6 other atoms not too far away. As you increase the pressure, barium goes from BCC to FCC. Face-centered cubic has 12 nearest neighbors. So everyone's happy. It's going from 8 to 12. It's got higher coordination. I'm happy. But at 25 GPA, it goes into a structure 288 atoms in a unit cell. Not, this is one element. It's going unsymmetrical with a vengeance. Okay? Not just 2 atoms in a unit cell, the crystal structure. You can get enough reflections to do a good crystal structure. It does that. Why would it do that? Here's rubidium-4 at 17 GPA. And what it does is it goes into a curious network, which looks to a chemist like a clathrate structure, where there are two sublattices of green atoms and of blue atoms, but they're both rubidium. Nothing else in there. The green sublattice in the blue sublattice, furthermore, the blue sublattice, which is these needles inside the channels of the other sublattice, these are incommensurate with, why would it do that? That's a crazy thing or matter to do. Okay, and this all was something, the beginnings of this is what Neil predicted. And so Neil, in a risky prediction in 1999, predicted that lithium, metallic lithium, would go out of closest pact. Metallic lithium has competitive BCC and FCC lattices. At low temperatures, thought to have another close pack lattice called 9R. Anyway, what he predicted in a work with Nelms is that lithium, that the valence electrons from lithium would go off the atom positions, which is where the red ones are, and into the interstitial regions, and the lithiums would pair up. This was a risky prediction. So what are risky predictions? Risky predictions are what make people believe theories. Risky predictions are when you assemble a panel of 100 experts in the field and 95 say that what the person who made the prediction says will not happen. That's a risky prediction, okay? So Einstein's prediction of the advancement of the perihelion of Mercury around 100 years ago was a risky prediction. This was a risky, he was wrong about the detailed structure. The Nelms group in Edinburgh found it was another structure than the one that Ashcroft predicted, but it was also asymmetrical. The electron, it didn't have the close back structure. So actually it was okay. So let's talk about close packing. So turns out that the close packing of spheres is a problem that was mathematically proven only about 20 years ago. But greengrocers in the Middle East knew that if they stack oranges, they should stack them like this, meaning that the most you can get is 6 spheres and 3 above and 3 below. And those are, I'm describing hexagonal and cubic closest packing. That maximizes space at 74%. Packing, this is something we teach our students in introductory chemistry and physics. There's nothing special about this. So how can you, why does it go, given that that's the best way to pack spheres? So let's look at this. Here's something that was written in 1727. And this is one of the first, this is the first textbook of agricultural chemistry. I can't get away today with entitling my articles like this, Vegetable Statics or an Account of Some Statical Experiments on the Sap in Vegetables Being an Essay Toward the Natural History. Can't do that. Okay, here's what Stephen Hales wrote in 1727. And he wrote, I compressed several fresh parcels of peas. I kept the orthography original, in the same pot with a force equal to so and so many pounds. He actually made a pot and he put a weight on it. Okay, experiment. So the peas dilated, yet they did not raise the lever because what they increased in bulk was by the great incumbent weight pressed into the interstices of the peas, which they adequately filled up, being thereby formed into pretty regular dodecahedrons. Not quite the dodecahedrons that you think, but not bad. So what is this saying? This is saying peas are not stupid. If you compress them, they will not stay spheres. Why should they? Why should they stay spheres? That's just the human being that's imposed on us. So Paul Chaykin at NYU does some research on this, which is a great delight to undergraduates because they can eat the products of the research center. So this is the packing. I can put this in scientific terms. This is the packing of ellipsoids, prolate, and oblate ellipsoids of revolution, okay? So it turns out that M&Ms pack a little bit better than spheres. Is this, look, this is not an accident. I mean, this is obvious. Cubes pack very well. Okay, things are not cubes. Matter is not cubes. I take two Canadian coins I have here. If I pack these Canadian coins in the plane, they will obey what the spheres, and their six nearest neighbors. But perpendicular to the plane, they pack 100%. Okay? So what are M&Ms? M&Ms are halfway between Canadian coins and spheres. So they'll pack a little better. Okay, so this is not a major discovery here, but it's something we should be aware. So, but there is a chemical perspective on this, which is relevant to the rubidium structure. How can you get something else? Why should something go into two sublattices? Well, in some way, it's sort of chemically apparent, and that is, when these are of equal size, there is a maximum packing. That's that 12 nearest neighbor. What if they are of unequal size? You remember those holes, the 26% of the holes in the spherical thing? If one of the spheres was very tiny, it could pack those holes very well. So packing a very big sphere and very tiny spheres is much more effective than packing. So how do you get inside one element? How do you get two sublattices of where the elements in the sublattice have unequal size? It's easy. You just transfer a piece of an electron to this from one to the other. And you make one sublattice have a positive charge, not a whole positive charge. This is a band structure. It's a D-low. A fraction of a charge is transferred from one sublattice to the other one. And the sublattice that is positively charged will, of course, be smaller. The electrostatic attraction will pull it in than the sublattice that's negatively charged. Now, actually, I want to show you. We're supposed to be doing real physics here. Here is real physics. This is a paper from Frank Stillinger and Salvatore Torquato about the phase diagram and structural diversity of densest binary sphere packings. And plotted in one dimension is the asymmetry in the size of the spheres, and this is the packing ratio. And there is a large, what they've explored is a large range, not all, and they found what are the optimum packings. This is by a computer exploration, but it's these are the top people in the field, and it is about right. So you could get closest packing if you get a disproportionation in charge, and there could be other things in these sublattices. I mentioned neutron stars. There are papers which show that in neutron stars, at those pressures, which are several orders of magnitude higher than those that are in these experiments, that you also get sublattices of unequal size in those, which is very interesting. Okay, I come now to the end. You can read more about this in this article with one graduate student, one postdoc, and two professors. About various considerations about pressure. I want to justify the word chemical in here. In the title I said the chemical imagination at work. So what's chemical here? What's chemical in what I've told you? It's not that van der Waals space is squeezed out. That's just colorful language around. You can equally well claim it for physics, but if you look at the variety of things that I've led you through, whether you liked it or not, like that silicon wants to be sixth coordinate, or that you can get, I didn't mention this, diborane type bonding in this, or that this, taking you through the Cambridge structural database to get some information on what happens at high pressure, or talking about the fractional charge moving from one lattice to another one. Yes, you could claim some of this for physics, but I why not? I will claim it for chemistry here. And what I'm doing is pushing the chemical perspective into a realm where it must fail at some point. At some point, at very high pressure, I'm going to get a plasma of nuclei and electrons, and all my chemical intuition is going to serve me no purpose whatsoever, and I'll have to do it in another way. But we can. One of the interesting theorems out there is that very high pressure, everything goes into a BCC structure of nuclei and electrons, and that's something to think about. It's a supposed theorem. I don't have the reference. I want to, in conclusion, just show you two slides. They actually have to do with this. So there is another reason why I'm interested in this realm. And it's a little bit of a story here. One reason is in the word playground. This is fun. This opens up a new world, this high pressure. A new world of chemical compositions, a world which is not available. It's not that I'm tired of the world of the 1 million compounds that chemists have made. There's plenty there. But this is a little different, and it's lots of fun. So it's a playground. But the personal philosophical one is this, that I have spent some time on the philosophical side talking about reductionism and why reductionism is... By reductionism, I mean a hierarchy of the sciences or human enterprises from humanity, social sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, maybe mathematics. And that not only that hierarchy, but also that understanding is defined in terms of reducing from the higher or lower hierarchy, whatever you call it, to the next one. So that understanding in biology is in terms of reducing it to chemistry and chemistry to physics. Okay, I think this is unrealistic, unworkable, and has many, and that's not the way human understanding proceeds. And I could tell you about that, but that's not what's important. I also am interested in particular, in the borderland between chemistry and physics. And so I wrote in the 1980s two articles, and then put them together into a book on solids and surfaces, A Chemist's View of Bonding and Extended Structures, which is essentially an introduction to the solid state physics for chemists, or it has two purposes. And I put those out there and I wrote the book. One was to, given that there is this wonderful meeting ground of chemistry and physics in the last 30, 40 years, a meeting ground defined by the fullerenes, by high temperature superconductors, by all kinds of fascinating magnetic materials. Given that there is this meeting ground, it would be good if to introduce chemists to the natural language for describing bonding in this, to describing electrons in a solid state, the language of band structures, densities of states, Fermi surfaces, and so on. And so I wrote this book where I wrote this introduction essentially with just one equation in the whole book. And that was so one purpose. So the reason I wanted to introduce this language because I didn't want the chemist to enter that middle ground feeling that the physicists understood it better. just because they had the control of the language. So I wanted to demystify that language. That's what I did, and it's been very successful. The other purpose was to introduce physicists to 150 years of thinking about bonding, about molecules and extended structures, in a way, instead of moving from bands to bonds, or to bands, I wanted to move the other way to see the relationship between what the physicists knew or had learned or I had taught them about the molecular orbitals of small molecules, and to use that language to understand band structures. But I wanted the physicists to appreciate a little the bond perspective. So I was moving bonds to bands in the other direction. So on the first of these goals of teaching chemists, entering the middle ground between chemistry and physics, teaching them something about the language of physics, it's been very successful, and there are several generations turn over rapidly, of chemists, solid-state chemists especially, who have learned from our books and as well as from other things, from this book as well as the others. On the second purpose of teaching or impressing physicists that there was anything of value in a bond perspective, nada, rien, ni arnoi kopeki, no chance. Okay? So they're a bunch of arrogant bastards. My daughter is a physicist, a PhD from Ohio State, and she is not that. But I understood the perspective, and so I gave up, kept quiet for a while. And then after we did this on solids and surfaces in the late 80s, I forgot to tell you the timeline, now all of a sudden, around the 2000s, we got into high pressure. And so all of a sudden, I realize I have another chance. Again, I'm encountering a community, chemistry and physics at work, and I have another chance. Will I get any different results? We'll have to see. Thank you.
So thanks very much. We start with if there's any questions from the students. And could I trouble somebody to just turn up the light? I think I can do it. But are there any questions from the students? Perfect. Thank you.
So when you're getting to these high pressures, are you actually distorting the electron density to achieve different symmetries, which changes the coordination? Is that?
Yes. But it's a chicken and egg question. I'm doing the calculation with a density functional methodology, which derives everything from the density. So the density, of course, distorts in a way which mirrors the distortions of the lattice. But it's hard to say which is first. Though I could distort the density and not move the nuclei, I usually get a higher energy than I get a lower energy if I move the nuclei in the way that the density. There is one exception, and that is a very interesting story, which I just hinted at a little bit, of the high pressure electrides. So again, I want to show you this because how beautiful the physics is and how surprising it is. So I think all of you have seen sodium metal. It's a metal, like if you haven't thrown it into a urinal, then at least you know what it does. In the laboratory experiments, it's a silvery, shiny metal, very reactive with water. Under a pressure of 80 gigapascals, sodium turns transparent and an insulator. And then you apply still more pressure, it turns back metallic and reflective. Transparent, so it's not reflective. So reflectivity is one of the properties of a metal. So what is happening there? What is happening there? So I'll tell you the physics. Roughly, it's the same thing that you saw in the lithium. Remember, I didn't talk about it, but I told you that Neil Ashcroft predicted that the electrons jump from the atoms into the interstices. So here is the sodium. So they're getting squeezed. There is a core. There is one electron in a 3s orbital. And that one electron, you're squeezing this together. And there is some space between the atoms. I mean, think of those 26% that weren't filled by the atom sizes, roughly. As you're squeezing this, this electron here is in all the energies go up. But in particular, the energies of the s orbitals turn out to go up more than those of p, more than those of d. I could show you why. But one reason that this goes up in energy more is that it has to stay orthogonal to the 1s and 2s. Remember the densities? The densities. The 1s is like, I'm plotting here, r squared psi squared. Like this, the 2s has a little bit here and then more out here. And the 3s has a little bit here, and then out here. That 3s electron is further away from the nucleus. I'm not saying anything special. 3s electron is further away from the nucleus than the 2s. Than the 1s. So when you apply pressure, pressure means that there is a wall moving in here. It affects that orbital more, goes up in energy more. At some point, that, as it's going up, that energy, the energy it goes up makes it jump to the empty space, of which there ain't much, but there is some. In here. Now, if it bothers you about empty space having orbitals, have you forgotten about a particle in a box? Empty space has orbitals with no potentials. But here there is some potential. But anyway, at some point, as you apply the pressure, the electrons jump from the outer or valence orbitals of the atom into the interstitial space. And what you get then is a lattice of Na plus electron minus, and or sometimes there are two electrons one in the space, and that's that. It turns out that lattice is semiconducting and no longer conducting. So that's an interesting. The electrons follow.
Other student questions? All right, let's open it up. Other questions?
When you were talking about rubidiums.
Yes.
And I may have misinterpreted what you said, but you explained that low symmetry structure partly in terms of basically disproportionation.
Yes, partial.
Yes. And I would expect that most of rubidium, actually cesium, in the alkali metals. And so if you were to find this unusual effect, it would be at the bottom of the periodic table.
Yeah.
Iodine metallizes, and you inferred that at various places, quite, I've forgotten, it's about 25, 20.
Very, very easy.
What happens thereafter? You go to a close-packed iodine structure at 20, 25, but if you kept pushing, do you get I plus, I minus?
That hasn't happened that I know. Hasn't been seen, but there are other. There is some disproportionation in other structures. Some of the disproportionation is structural. So ammonia under very high pressure goes into this. But that's chemistry happening. Goes into a lattice of these. Water is very interesting. Under relatively little pressure, water goes, loses the identity of the hydrogen bonds and goes into, in ICE 10, this is not Kurt Vonnegut's ICE 9, but in ICE 10, you get a lattice essentially of O2 minuses with symmetrical H pluses tetrahedrally disposed around this. And at all higher pressures, water doesn't take turn metallic until about 4 terapascals in calculations, 4,000 gigapascals, very high pressure. Ionicity survives, ionicity in the sense of reaching a noble gas structure, survives still the very highest pressures in general. But anyway, water is very nice because you can see the what you can see is in the experiments is people observe the Raman spectrum of water, and they can see the OH stretching vibration, and it softens. So usually when you apply pressure, if you have a vibration, a quadratic potential near the minimum of something. When you apply pressure and move it to, usually you sharpen the potential in here. But in water, the OH stretch moves to lower frequency. And what's happening is it's going symmetrical. So it's starting out with two full bonds and two hydrogen bonds. And now as you increase the pressure, these weaken, these lengthen, and these shorten. And that you can see that in the Raman. Very nice.
So the sodium cartoon that you've got on the board there, presumably the S orbitals, the energy of the S orbitals goes up faster than the energy of the
two orbitals. Yes.
Because they're spherical, right? Because they're not deformed. All right.
Because they've got, no, the S goes up because it's got, the S has got more cores to stay orthogonal. Okay.
So, I'm wondering if you, at any point before you get the electrons moving into the interstitial space, whether the relative energies of the 3S and the 3P orbitals switch.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Very high pressure. So, this is very interesting. Let me tell you in terms of atomic physics just how interesting this is. Let's go back to lithium, which is the first place one sees this. So the first thing, first of all, what I've just described to you in terms of the level switching in is goes back to Fermi in 1945. Who we know had great insight. He didn't publish a paper, but somebody else quotes Fermi. And it goes in cesium, and the same is true also for potassium. These become transition metals under pressure. So instead of having this, they become 3D1, 4S0. Like this, they promote, and the reason is that the d orbital is least affected by the pressure, whereas the S one is going up. Now, for the atomic ones, this is so interesting. So here is lithium, 1s, and then 2s below 2p. And lithium has got three electrons like this. So lithium, the ground state of lithium is a doublet s, and a doublet p with two electrons in there is an excited state. But as you apply the pressure, this goes up, and this goes like that. And at some point, so why are these? These are due to Coulomb interactions. At the pressure operates opposite to the Coulomb force. And at some pressure, which is thought to be pretty high, unfortunately, this has not been observed, but is calculated, lithium will go over to being a doublet P ground state instead of a doublet S. This is so much fun. Not everything is turned upside down, but it's changed. And it's changed in ways it's changed in ways which we can understand from the physics of this. The fact that I can draw this on a board for you is telling you how simple it is. No calculation. Yes.
You didn't talk about the temperature, only about pressure.
Right.
Is there a temperature limit for that?
So, temperature. So, Cynthia, I only talked about high pressure. You could have asked about low pressure. But low pressure is non-trivial if you're going to make it isotropic. So, yes, you can go to low pressure. You can go 10 to the minus 10th atmosphere. But then the solid will go out here, and the gas will stay there. But can you apply isotropically a pressure less than one atmosphere to a homogeneous material? Can you make mercury at 10 to the minus 10th torr, but be it a gas of mercury? It's non-trivial. You can approach things in this interesting. Okay, temperature. Temperature, very low temperature, you know, there is a lot of interesting things at very low temperature, like Bose condensation and other things. At high temperature, from a chemical viewpoint, there is less interest. I once made the mistake in a talk saying there is no chemistry on the surface of the sun. I just said it. And what I was thinking was that 10,000 degrees, there's going to be no H2 molecules there. Whereupon the next day, an astrophysicist in the audience sent me an absorption spectrum of H2 from a solar flare. So in fact, in the interior of the sun, it is all hydrogen atoms and the population of H2 molecule and H+. But the population of H2 molecules is small. But in a solar flare, the things we see in an eclipse, the stuff is cooling. And when it's cooled to 4,000 degrees, and then you have H condenses into H2, and the light of the sun passing through that H2 gives you a beautiful Rydberg series in the absorption spectrum of H2. So, and the spectra of, maybe you've seen a spectra of brown dwarfs or of other astrophysical objects. They are just full of lines of molecules
But that would not be high pressure, right?
No, that's not high pressure.
So what about high pressure and high temperature?
And high temperature. Many interesting things. One of the interesting things for hydrogen itself is still unsolved, is there have been in calculations two coexisting liquid phases of H2 at height. If you start to think about that, that's very interesting, that there could be liquids, but two different liquids that are immiscible, maybe, or maybe miscible. There are other, in liquid ammonia, there are two liquid phases that are known under atmospheric conditions. So yes, temperature and pressure, as you increase, there is one question is, so one question, where is the critical point for hydrogen, for instance, in this usual diagram that we have? This critical point, where is it for hydrogen? Another question is there a turnover in a melting curve for hydrogen? So temperature is going this, sorry, pressure is going this way. Temperature is going this way. The phase diagram for sodium that I and lithium known experimentally so far goes like this. Then what's known peters out. This is about 500. No, this is about 200 GPa for lithium. So let me translate this. It starts out, here is room temperature. You increase the temperature and the at some point it melts over here. And now under pressure, the melting point first increases. This is normal behavior. But at some point, there is a turnover. That is very interesting. And this curve incredibly goes down almost to room temperature. And this is the region where it's an insulator also. Then it rises again. For hydrogen, people are now discussing whether it's turning over or if it's going up. The liquid-liquid transitions are up here. There's all kinds of phase behavior for high temperature, high pressure. That's an interesting.
So given that it's past 3:30, let me suggest we continue question period downstairs in the bistro where we have some snacks. But before we do that, let's thank Paul again.